Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, confronting the authorities, with advice from historian Jill Lepore and environmental activist Derek Jensen. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week's show features two items, different on the surface, but connected underneath. We'll start with a nice little movie by Jordan Brown. The movie's audio is a reading of a very good essay by the radical environmental activist Derek Jensen. The title is Forget Shorter Showers. The powers that be, the authorities, will gladly let you be a tree-hugging environmental activist, just as long as you stay out of politics and confine your activism to the pursuit of purely personal purity and personal zero-carbon footprint. Go ahead, walk instead of drive, become a vegan, grow vegetables, compost your garbage, avoid all plastics, and feel superior to the riffraff. Jensen correctly notes that no such changes in individual lifestyle, even by millions of people, will accomplish anywhere near enough to save the planet. Saving the planet requires, at a minimum, concerted action by groups to effect a radical change in the politics, the economics, and the power structure of the Western nations. Here is Jordan Brown's film of 2015, Forget Shorter Showers.
Would any sane person think that dumpster diving would have stopped Hitler, or that composting would have ended slavery, or brought about the 8-hour workday, or that chopping wood and carrying water would have gotten people out of Tsarist prisons? Or that dancing around a fire would have helped put in place the Voting Rights Act of 1957 or the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Then why now, with all the world at stake, do so many people retreat into these entirely personal solutions? Part of the problem is that we've been victims of a campaign of systematic misdirection. Consumer culture and the capitalist mindset have taught us to substitute acts of personal lifestyle choices for organized political resistance. The same is true for spiritual enlightenment. This is not organized political resistance. An inconvenient truth helped raise consciousness about global warming. But did you notice that all of the solutions presented had to do with personal consumption, changing light bulbs, inflating tires, driving half as much, and had nothing to do with shifting power away from corporations or stopping the growth economy that is destroying the planet?
Each one of us is a cause of global warming, but each of us can make choices to change that. With the things we buy, the electricity we use, the cars we drive, we can make choices to bring our individual carbon emissions to zero.
But even if every person in the United States did everything the movie suggested, US carbon emissions would fall by only 22%. And scientific consensus is that emissions must be reduced by at least 75% worldwide. Or let's talk water. We so often hear that the world is running out of water. People are dying from lack of water. Rivers are dewatered from lack of water. And while this is true, we're told that because of this, we must take shorter showers. But see the disconnect? Because I take showers, I'm responsible for drawing down aquifers? Well, no. More than 90% of the water used by humans is used by agriculture and industry. The remaining 10% is split between municipalities and actual living, breathing individual humans. Collectively, municipal golf courses use as much water as municipal human beings. That's insane. People, both human people and fish people, aren't dying because the world is running out of water. They're dying because the water is being stolen. Well, let's talk energy. Kirkpatrick Sale summarised it well. For the past 15 years, the story has been the same every year. Individual consumption, residential, by private car and so on, is never more than about a quarter of all consumption. The vast majority is commercial, industrial, corporate, by agribusiness and government, if you've got the military. So even if we all took up cycling and wood stoves, it would have a negligible impact on energy use, global warming and atmospheric pollution. Well, let's talk waste. In 2005, per capita municipal waste production, basically everything that's put out at the curb, in the United States was about 1,660 pounds. Let's say you're a diehard simple living activist, and you reduce this number to zero. You recycle everything. You bring cloth bags shopping. You fix your toaster. Your toes poke out of your old tennis shoes. You're not done yet, though. Since municipal waste includes not just residential waste, but also waste from government offices and businesses, you march down to those offices, waste reduction pamphlets in hand, and convince them to cut down on their waste enough to eliminate your share of it. Well, I've got some bad news. The municipal waste accounts for only 3% of total waste production in the United States. I want to be clear. I'm not saying that we shouldn't live simply. I live reasonably simply myself. But I don't pretend that not buying much, or not driving much, or not having kids is a powerful political act, or that it's deeply revolutionary. Because it isn't. Personal change does not equal social change. So how then, and especially with all the world at stake, have we come to accept these utterly insufficient responses? I think part of it is that we're in a double bind. A double bind is when you're given multiple options, but no matter what option you choose, you lose. And withdrawal is not an option. At this point, it should be pretty easy to recognise that every action involving the industrial economy is destructive. And we shouldn't pretend that solar photovoltaics, for example, exempt us from this. They still require mining and transportation infrastructures at every point in the production process. The same can be said for every other so-called green technology. If we choose option one, if we avidly participate in the industrial economy, we may think in the short term we win, because we may accumulate wealth, the marker of so-called success in this culture, but we lose, because in so doing we give up our empathy, our animal humanity. And we really lose because industrial civilization is killing the planet, which means everyone loses. And if we choose the alternative option of living more simply, thus causing less harm, but still not stopping the industrial economy from killing the planet, we may in the short term think we win because we got to feel pure and we didn't even have to give up all of our empathy, you know, just enough to justify not stopping the horror. But once again, we really lose because industrial civilization is killing the planet, which means everyone still loses. The third option, acting decisively to stop the industrial economy, is very scary for a number of reasons, including but not restricted to the fact that we'd lose some of the luxuries, for example, electricity, to which we've grown very accustomed. And the fact that those in power might try to kill us if we seriously impede their ability to exploit the world. None of which alters the fact that it's a better option than a dead planet. Any option is a better option than a dead planet. Besides being ineffective at causing the sorts of changes necessary to stop this culture from killing the planet, there are at least four other problems with perceiving simple living as a political act, as opposed to living simply because that's what you want to do. The first is that it's predicated on the flawed notion that humans inevitably harm their land base. Simple living as a political act consists solely of harm reduction, ignoring the fact that humans can help the Earth as well as harm it. We can rehabilitate streams, We can get rid of noxious invasives. We can remove dams. We can disrupt a political system tilted towards the rich, as well as an extractive economic system. We can destroy the industrial economy that is destroying the real physical world. The second problem, and this is another big one, is that it incorrectly assigns blame to the individual, and most especially to individuals who are particularly powerless, instead of to those who actually wield power in this system, and to the system itself. The third problem is that it accepts capitalism's redefinition of us from citizens to consumers. By accepting this redefinition, we reduce our potential forms of resistance to consuming and not consuming. But citizens have a much wider range of available resistance tactics, including voting or not voting, running for office, pamphleting, boycotting, organizing, lobbying, protesting. And when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we have the right to alter or abolish it. The fourth problem is that the end point of the logic behind simple living as a political act is suicide. If every act within an industrial economy is destructive, and if we want to stop this destruction, and if we are unwilling or unable to question, much less destroy, the intellectual, moral, economic, and physical infrastructures that cause every act within an industrial economy to be destructive, then we can easily come to believe that we will cause the least destruction possible if we're dead. The good news is that there are other options. We can follow the examples of brave activists who lived through the difficult times I mentioned. Nazi Germany, Tsarist Russia, antebellum United States, who did far more than manifest a form of personal purity. They actively opposed the injustices that surrounded them. We can follow the example of those who remembered that the role of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much personal integrity as possible, but rather to confront and take down those systems. Let's get to work.
Forget Shorter Showers, featuring the prose of environmental activist Derek Jensen. I kind of wish Jensen would use the adjective nonviolent once in a while, especially when talking about overthrowing established power, even if for only tactical reasons. You're not going to outgun the Fortune 500 and its Praetorian Guard, the United States Armed Forces, and police forces. Speaking of violence, let us read some more of Jill Lepore's History of the Police, The Long Blue Line. In the first installment, Lepore talked about the Anglo-American predecessors of the police force, especially the slave patrols. For Lepore, the history of policing is inextricably connected with the control of enslaved black people in the Americas. This week, she discusses how the police is also inextricably connected with the military, particularly the military of a colonizing and imperialist nation. That's us, especially since the Spanish-American War of the 1890s. Let us resume our reading. In 1779, Thomas Jefferson created a chair in Law and Police at the College of William and Mary. The meaning of the word began to change. In 1789, Jeremy Bentham, noting that police had recently entered the English language in something like its modern sense, made this distinction. Bentham said, "Police keep the peace, justice punishes disorder." "No justice, no peace," Black Lives Matter protesters cry in the streets. Then, in 1797, a London magistrate named Patrick Colquhoun published a treatise on the police of the metropolis. He, too, distinguished peace kept in the streets from justice administered by the courts. Police were responsible for the regulation and correction of behavior, and the prevention and detection of crimes, claimed Colquhoun. It is often said that Britain created the police and the United States copied it. One could argue that the reverse is true. The Brit Colquhoun spent his teens and early 20s in colonial Virginia, and he had served as an agent for British cotton manufacturers and owned shares in sugar plantations in Jamaica. He knew all about slave codes and slave patrols. But nothing came of Colquhoun's ideas about policing until 1829, when Home Secretary Robert Peel, in the wake of a great deal of labor unrest, and after years of suppressing Catholic rebellions in Ireland in his capacity as Irish Secretary, Peel persuaded Parliament to establish the Metropolitan Police. This was a force of 3,000 men, headed by two civilian justices, later called commissioners, and organized like an army, with each superintendent overseeing 4 inspectors, 16 sergeants, and 165 constables. The constables wore coats and pants of blue with black top hats, each assigned a numbered badge and a baton. Londoners came to call these men Bobbies, for Home Secretary Bobby Peel. It is often said that modern American urban policing began in 1838, when the Massachusetts legislature authorized the hiring of police officers in Boston. This, too, ignores the role of slavery in the history of the police. In 1829, a black abolitionist in Boston named David Walker published An Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World, calling for violent rebellion. He wrote, "One good black man can put to death 6 white men." Walker was found dead within the year, and Boston thereafter had a series of mob attacks against abolitionists, including an attempt to lynch William Lloyd Garrison, the publisher of The Liberator, in 1835. Walker's words terrified Southern slave owners. The governor of North Carolina wrote to his state senators, "I beg you will lay the matter before the police of your town and invite their prompt attention to the necessity of arresting the circulation of this book." By police, he meant slave patrols. In response to Walker's appeal, North Carolina formed a statewide patrol committee. New York established a police department in 1844. New Orleans and Cincinnati followed in 1852. Then, later in the 1850s, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Baltimore. Population growth, the widening inequality brought about by the Industrial Revolution, and the rise of such crimes as prostitution and burglary all contributed to the emergence of urban policing. So did immigration, especially from Ireland and Germany, and the hostility to immigration. A new party, the Know-Nothings, sought to prevent immigrants from voting, holding office, and becoming citizens. In 1854, Boston disbanded its ancient watch and formally established a police department. That year, Know-Nothings swept the city's elections. American police differed from their English counterparts. In the U.S., police commissioners, as political appointees, fell under local control with limited supervision, and law enforcement was decentralized, resulting in a jurisdictional thicket. In 1857, in the Great Police Riot, the New York Municipal Police run by the mayor's office, fought on the steps of City Hall with the New York Metropolitan Police, run by the state. The Metropolitans were known as the New York Mets. That year, an amateur baseball team of the same name was founded. Also, unlike their British counterparts, American police carried guns, initially their own. In the 1860s, the Colt Firearms Company began manufacturing a compact revolver called a pocket police model. American police carried guns because Americans carried guns, including Americans who lived in parts of the country where they hunted for food and defended their livestock from wild animals. Americans who lived in parts of the country that had no police, and Americans who lived in parts of North America that were not in the United States. Outside big cities, law enforcement officers were scarce. In the territories that weren't yet states, there were U.S. Marshals and their deputies. These were officers of the federal courts who could act as de facto police, but only to enforce federal laws. If a territory became a state, its counties could elect sheriffs. Meanwhile, Americans became vigilantes, especially likely to kill indigenous people and to lynch people of color. Between 1840 and the 1920s, mobs, vigilantes, and law officers, including the Texas Rangers, lynched some 500 Mexicans and Mexican Americans, and killed thousands more, not only in Texas, but also in territories that became the states of California, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico. A San Francisco Vigilance Committee, established in 1851, arrested, tried, and hanged people. It boasted a membership in the thousands. An L.A. Vigilance Committee targeted and lynched Chinese immigrants. The U.S. Army operated as a police force, too. After the Civil War, the militia was organized into seven new departments of permanent standing armies. In the 1870s and 80s, the U.S. Army engaged in more than 1,000 combat operations against native peoples. In 1890, at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, following an attempt to disarm a Lakota settlement, a regiment of cavalrymen massacred hundreds of Lakota men, women, and children. Nearly a century later, in 1973, FBI agents, SWAT teams, federal troops, and state marshals lay siege to Wounded Knee during a protest over police brutality and the failure to properly punish the torture and murder of an Oglala Sioux man named Raymond Yellow Thunder. They fired more than 500,000 rounds of ammunition and arrested more than 1,000 people. Today, according to the CDC, Native Americans are more likely to be killed by the police than any other racial or ethnic group. Modern American policing began in 1909 when August Vollmer became the chief of the police department in Berkeley, California. Vollmer refashioned American police into an American military. He had served with the 8th Army Corps in the Philippines in 1898. Quote, "For years, ever since Spanish-American War days, I've studied military tactics and used them to good effect in rounding up crooks," he later explained. Quote, "After all, we're conducting a war against the enemies of society," unquote. Jill Lepore then speaks in her own voice. Who were these enemies? Mobsters, bootleggers, socialist agitators, strikers, union organizers, immigrants, and black people. to domestic policing, Vollmer and his peers adapted the kinds of tactics and weapons that had been deployed against Native Americans in the West, and against colonized people in other parts of the world, including Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. Vollmer instituted a training model imitated all over the country by police departments that were often led and staffed by other veterans of the United States Wars of Conquest and Occupation. Detroit's Commissioner of Police said, quote, "A police captain or lieutenant should occupy exactly the same position in the public mind as that of a captain or lieutenant in the United States Army," unquote. Today's police officers are disproportionately veterans of U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, many of them suffering from post-traumatic stress. The Marshall Project, analyzing data from the Albuquerque police, found that officers who are veterans are more likely than their non-veteran counterparts to be involved in fatal shootings. In general, they are more likely to use force and more likely to fire their guns. Here we will pause for this week our reading of Jill Lepore's article on the history of police and policing, The Long Blue Line, published in the New Yorker magazine, July 20th, 2020. We'll pick up the article again in our next new installment. One takeaway from today's reading: the increasing militarization of our police forces has concerned citizens for the past several decades. Lepore's history shows that the police forces have always been militarized since their very founding over a century ago. If we want a different style of policing, we have to go back to the drawing board and imagine a radically different way of keeping the peace. Just as Derek Jensen says, if we want to save the planet, we have to imagine a radically different system of political and economic power. Not just imagine it, but bring it about. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. To hear more, check out our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, try to live each day as though the truth were true, and please tune in again next week. Till then.